Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Fidelia. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, County, Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Thank you very much, Audrey. One more time, we're on. I don't know how much longer they'll allow this, but here we go again for show number 4816. Is that right, Mike? Something close to that, I think. Welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network, a great network where you can broadcast worldwide, and particularly this Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm your host, Keith Haley. I want to thank Johnny Cash again for taking us across the country to 92 cities and states. Try that song from memory sometime when you got absolutely nothing else to do. It's hard to sing, and he did it without looking at lyrics. Emily and Mike, thank you very much tonight. You did a good job on getting us some super news stories this evening, and Mike, you might even have a comment on one of them. Am I correct? I'll try to contain you on this one, on this particular one. But we're here to discuss news issues and events and developments in this always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. We dedicate the show to our police and courts and corrections and juvenile justice people who are so dedicated, and they serve us tirelessly around the world and across the United States and other places we don't even know about. We look inside criminal justice and we take a close-up look at our professionals at work. Tonight is going to be a very interesting show. I'm not going to give you too much of a tip about it, but this guy's got an interesting perspective. It's shall I say, unique. And it has to do with changing our crime statutory setup and our punishment system. And I'll let Professor Kleiman talk about it, but it's Mark Kleiman. And he's talking about when brute force fails, what can we do? He says how to have less crime and less punishment. Now, how can that be? Less crime and less punishment. Hold on, and he'll tell you in just a little while. You're on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Remember, you can get your own show. If you're listening, you can get your own show. So that's something that's very nice. And there are shows on everything imaginable. I mean, everything imaginable. I wanted to look at the cancer show that's always advertised. They paid the money to be like a feature show. But it sounds like a very interesting, noble purpose type of show. I've never listened to it. It might be. But everybody in the world is on Blog Talk Radio. If you go searching around, you'll see people, celebrities, politicians, whatever, on and on and on and on. And there's even that thing called the Jumble Justice radio show. So there should be something on there to amuse everyone at least once or twice. And these shows are archived, by the way, and then you can download them in MP3 format. And you can also go to podcastdirectory.com and type in the Jumble Justice show, and you can get all of our shows from beginning to end in chronological order from which they were given. Well, let's take a little bit a look tonight at some criminal justice news after I kind of do that. You can listen. We might have a caller tonight. I'm not sure, but you can call in if you want, and that number is 347-996-5734, 347-996-5734, and we can hold a bunch of people now. So if 50 of you call in, I think we can hold all of you at the same time on this new studio switchboard, very sophisticated board. Some things I'm still trying to figure out on it, but I think there's a manual somewhere, right? Right, Emily? Right, I never check manuals. I just kind of think I can do it without those. But anyway, Audrey, you have a blonde joke for tonight. Let's go ahead and take care of that, and then we'll get to our news here in just a little bit. Audrey, of course, is a collector of blonde jokes, and she's collected them since the beginning of time. Tonight's joke is a rather short one, but very interesting. Go ahead, Audrey.
Professor Haley, I have real short blonde joke for tonight. It is funny, however, so I will provide it for our listeners. I hope they enjoy it. Here it is. A blonde was sitting in class when the professor asked her if she knew what the Roe versus Wade decision was. She sat there for quite a while pondering this very profound question and finally said, "I think that is the decision George Washington made prior to crossing the Delaware."
All right, Audrey, that's that is a keeper for sure. We enjoyed that one. And ladies and gentlemen, on a much more serious note, you know, we have a new firearms concealed carry law going to become effective here in September in the state of Ohio. And we're going to do a whole show on that. We may do that next week, actually. And we'll talk about some of the details of that law, but essentially what it does that people are really talking about is that it allows concealed carry holders who hold a license to go into places that serve alcohol. They're not permitted to drink. It's a felony if they drink. And there's some other specifications of the law that are very interesting, and it'd be interesting to see what the various commentary is about this law. But anyway, the Ohio Coalition against Firearms here in Ohio, they would like for the criminals to hear this public service announcement. Take proper heed and go in and turn in their guns and give up their life of crime. Go ahead, Ohio Coalition.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Need I say that the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence was against the concealed carry law in the state of Ohio. Well, let's do a green tip. Somebody told me today that it was kind of warm. I haven't heard a weather report for at least 3 minutes. We've now got the heat index, we've got the temperature, we've got some other things. I think it's all a plot on the part of these weather forecasters, particularly on television, that they now stand in front of their new video graphics. You've seen the big red, they can make the maps red and yellow and shades and all that business. They have to show that. And they're dressing accordingly. Have you noticed that? They're dressing to match the climate color symbol that's on the map, but it can't be that simple. It has to be more complicated than that. But anyway, there is a green tip. Al Gore is going to be at it again here in the fall, apparently, to help us save the planet. And when it's so hot, you never know what happened. We could wake up tomorrow morning, there's no more water anywhere. But here's an interesting green tip, and it's appropriate for right now. It's number 824 in ESMA Floyd's little book, 1001 Ways to Save the Planet. So number 824 says, turn off your air conditioner. Don't forget to turn off the air conditioning in your hotel or your guest room when you're inside. Air conditioning is energy intensive. And what's the point of cooling a room if you're not in it? But you do the same thing when you're home, correct? If you haven't have air conditioning, a lot of people don't. A lot of people don't. But if you have air conditioning, turn off your air conditioner when you leave, and just think of the energy you're saving. You'll smile all day when you do this, and you'll be a little altruistic. I mean, you know, you could be proud the fact is you're saving energy when others are leaving their air conditioners on. Let's take a look at some of this criminal justice news, and a little bit of this borders on insanity, but that's the truth every week, right? We said the show is about humorous things once in a while in criminal justice. So let me take a look at, we get the news flipped up here. We use Evernote for that in case people don't know. This one's not totally insane, but it's halfway down the path. Governor Deval Patrick and state Connecticut, he's introduced legislation. He's trying to get a bill passed that's been kind of stagnant there. And what this bill does, it will make illegal immigrants pay the reduced resident rate of tuition in state colleges and universities. If you come in from out of state and go to a college or university like a state school, your tuition is usually like double what it is for someone as a resident. So what Deval Patrick is claiming that we really ought to be treating these people. He says we're talking about real people here, individuals, students, and families whose ambitions are caught up in the only community in most cases that they know. So in other words, let's let them go to school. Now, when they go to school for in-state tuition, then other things come into play, and I'll bet if you trace a few of your tax dollars that you pay, that you'll be paying for illegal immigrants. Now, they did have a qualification. You did have to be here. You did have to hide out for 3 years. In other words, the student had to go to high school at least 3 years in the state. So we'll see what happens if this thing actually gets off the ground. But it's did I say Connecticut? State of Massachusetts. I'm sorry. but anyway, I always got those confused. I could tell you why, but it's a long story. There's no excuse. But anyway, what would you be? 11 other states do this. How would you be in terms of your side on this particular issue? You know, all criminals aren't bad. Did you know that, Mike? Here's the nice guy, Mr. White. He's a suspect in Society Hill robberies. And what he did is he robbed robberies and he taxed women on the streets of Philadelphia. And in one of these robberies, he saw the surveillance video released by the police this week that showed him near the crime scene. And when he found out that cop investigators came to his family's house to talk to them, he heard about this. And at 3 p.m. here Wednesday, yesterday, he went and turned himself in at police headquarters. Isn't that great? I mean, what a nice criminal. He's charged with one count of robbery at this particular time, but I think that probably robbers don't stop with one. Once you do one, there's always another one that they can do. But isn't that a nice guy? They see the surveillance camera data, which is, you know, doesn't happen that often, really. And he goes down and turns himself in. Have you heard about the border fence in Arizona? What an idea! It is a website that, called buildtheborderfence.com. Take a look at it. They update it fairly regularly, I think. And they've already gotten 884 online donations. They're taking up donations to build a fence. They've already taken in $39,085 within the first 17 hours when the site was up. And so what they're going to do is take this, they're going to take this, and their gifts range from $5 to dozens of them in $250 and in the $250 to $500 range. And what they're trying to do is get enough money to build some type of border thing there. What happens here is Arizona Senate President Russell Pierce, you've probably heard about him, State Attorney General Tom Horn, Maricopa County Sheriff, yes, Sheriff Joe, he's there, and others, supporters, they gathered this Wednesday, yesterday, in Smith's Casa Grande District to kick off the fundraising campaign. But what a great idea. They think this is going to take with the fundraising potential, because people have donated nearly $3.8 million to fund the state's 2010 immigrant enforcement law, known as Senate Bill 1010. You know what that's all about? The federal government suing them to stop the enforcement of this law that says when the cops stop you for a legal violation first, in other words, probable cause, then in the course of checking your ID, like your driver's license, registration, etc., if there's reasonable suspicion that your ID is false or you don't have any, then they're allowed to inquire farther to see if you're an illegal immigrant. What a terrible idea, right? How intrusive
they stopped you. But anyway, that movement to combat the federal government suit to get a legal team together, they've already collected $3.8 million. This is serious business to the folks in Arizona. This border, you know, is about 2,000 miles total. Of course, the Democrats say that this is misguided and it's a piecemeal approach to the border. What they want to do is knock down all border controls, and then there won't be any problem whatsoever, right? We won't have to worry about it at all. But anyway, it's going to be interesting to see how this turns out. But this fence, our border is about 2,000 miles, and about a seventh of this thing is actually protected to any level of security. And I've been there, and I've seen the broken-down barbed wire fence that goes for miles and miles. So it's not hard to get in and out of our country illegally if you choose to do that. So it's interesting, though. You know, it's a private donation site, and if you want to donate, you can go to that. It's buildtheborderfence.com and see what you can do in that particular thing. Have you heard about the new iPhone attachment? Yes, it's called Morris. Of course, we'd have to have an acronym if it's police technology, right? It's a mobile offender recognition and information system, Morris. What this does, it costs about $3,000 a whack, and it attaches to a police officer's iPhone, and he can hold it up to your eyeball, and the device will scan. It's a facial scanning device that slides over an iPhone, and it helps the person that get identified, and they do it by looking the iris of their eye. In fact, what the ACLU is worried about, that they can even do this, they're thinking, the cops say no and the chief says no, that they could do this 5 or 6 so feet away from you and actually get your ID, who you are, and have no reason to even inquire. In other words, they'd be snooping a little bit with this thing, but the chief says, that's not going to happen, but it's supposed to be more accurate than fingerprints. They say in the jail, this one a police administrator says that in the jail, you know, when somebody gets released from jail, they've got like 1,650 inmates in jail. They use that to make sure that they don't release the wrong person. Do people realize that happens more than you think? A guy's supposed to get out of jail, but the guy getting out ain't the one who's supposed to. really weird. But prison escapes is a very interesting subject. My friend Dr. George Wilson from North Carolina Central, he was with me at Cincinnati for a long time. George wrote his doctoral dissertation on prison escapes, of all things. And it... His conclusions were interesting. I've probably mentioned it on the show before. He did not prove his hypothesis. In fact, the opposite was true. He thought that the abnormal types would be the ones that would, try to escape from prison, and as often as they could. But what he found out, measured by the MMPI, Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory Test, that the ones that came out normal were the ones that wanted to escape. They wanted to be home with their children, wives, husbands, et cetera, like that. And the ones that weren't normal, that showed up odd, they love prison. You know, all the food you can get, TV, basketball. Well, I won't mention other things, but it's all there. anyway, it's an interesting idea. But this iPhone thing is going to be interesting. Technology stepping right up there, isn't it? In other words, we can look at your eyeballs and tell who you are. Really something. Okay, if you're traveling this summer, which many people are, I don't know if it's going to happen in the United States, but Crowne Plaza Hotel has now designated people who are officers who are snore patrol officers. They've had complaints for years of people in motel and hotel rooms that snore so loud they keep other people awake. So now what they're doing, they're having snore absorption rooms at 10 of their hotels in Europe and the Middle East, and it'll probably be coming here. And the snore patrol, the snore monitors patrol corridors in the designated quiet zones of Crowne Plaza hotels in the cities of London, Leeds, and Manchester. And their job is to listen out for offensive noises and to knock on the doors of guests who snore too loudly. Now, jumping back to the last story, couldn't that be replaced by technology? I could be wrong, but I think a speaker or something, our monitor, audio monitor, could pick that up. But no, they have snore police now. So that's going to be interesting. And the woman describes what she does. She says she goes up and down the hall and checks for people snoring. Don't know if that'd be the most exciting job in the world, especially when you're not finding any snorers. But an ounce of prevention, I guess, is actually worth that. Well, let's finish with this news story tonight so that you can hear a lot about this particular approach to crime and punishment. But this one I thought is interesting. Lawyers, it's hard for them to find work all over the place, but what this is about is the National Football League is being sued by 75 former National Football League players. They filed a lawsuit in Los Angeles Superior Court this week that alleges that the league has covered up the harmful effects of concussions since the 1920s. And former Miami Dolphin, I would know a dolphin from a stingray, but former Miami Dolphin wide receiver Mark Duper and former New York Giants running back Otis Anderson and Rodney Hampton were among the litigants in the potentially explosive suit. And what they're saying is that the NFL has covered up the fact that being hit in the head, even with your helmet on, could hurt you. It can cause dementia, memory loss, some other kinds of things. So they're saying that the NFL covered this up. Now, I don't know. There's not an IQ test to be a football player, is there? I think boxers would realize, they would not sue the boxers, because boxers realize when you get hit in the head a lot, he can do something to you. the idea is not to get hit, but maybe that's what we could do, is teach them boxing techniques, fainting and, getting out of the way and that type of thing, slipping hits and all that. Maybe we could teach that to the football players. That makes the game a little more entertaining for me. Well, I guess you can sue somebody for anything nowadays, can't you? But wouldn't somebody that's being hit in the head a lot in a football game begin to think after a while that maybe this hurts or could hurt you over the long run? I don't know. Have to be interesting to see how this one turns out. I'm going to do one more story. Did you know that summer heat can cause crime? Beaumont Hospital psychiatrist Dr. William Miles said there's a lot of data showing that the heat makes us angry and irritated and crime and suicides go up, but no one really understands why. Now, could I make a proposition about why this may be taking place? If it's hot, and a lot of people don't have air conditioning, that more people are out. When more people are out, it's more crowded and congested. And in most all studies, it shows that the more crowded and congested an environment is, that means for the robbers, the pickpockets, the sneak thieves, the rapists, there's more people to choose from, right? That could have something to do with crime. Now, when the temperature goes down 15 below zero in Montana, would you imagine that the burglary rate goes down? Even burglars get cold. But this psychiatrist, he has no idea. He's wondering what's going on about this. Of course, he's using a mental health thesis here about what causes this. But anyway, write that down. Crime goes up when the temperature goes up. What a truism. We can't afford not to talk about that. Well, let's go ahead and switch over to Book TV. We're going to go there again. And what we're going to have tonight is Professor Mark Kleiman, and he's professor of public policy at the University of California, not a bad place to work. And he argues that the solution to rising crime and overcrowded punishment is to clearly specify laws and then deliver the promised sanctions every time. In other words, no plea negotiations, no leniency. Give everybody essentially the same thing. So it's kind of an interesting idea. And let's go ahead and plug into him, and I think you'll enjoy it. You never make it through all these presentations on our evening shows when we use blog, when we use Book TV, but listen to this one, and then you can go there yourself and search him in the search box. His name is Kleiman, K-L-E-I-M-A-N. And there you can get the rest of the story. But here we go with a very interesting set of ideas.
Public policy professor Mark Kleiman argues that focused zero tolerance is the solution to rising crime and overcrowded punishment. He argues that laws should be clearly specified and the promised sanction should be delivered every time. The event is an hour. Anyway, I want to welcome everybody here this afternoon and for taking the time to come on a Friday afternoon to discuss a very important subject that I think you guys will find intriguing. And before I introduce our speaker, I want to briefly discuss my own interest in this issue. I was first elected to Congress in 2002, and that year when I campaigned, I met with a lot of different groups of people. I met with parents and teachers and principals and law enforcement leaders and other community activists. And the common theme emerged as a result of those meetings. And all of these groups agreed on one thing. You wouldn't think that they would all agree on the same thing, but they did. Basically, they all told me that crime, youth crime, was a huge problem in our area. They agreed that too many of our young people were dropping out of school. Too many young adults were participating in drug and gang violence. And too many families were broken with sons, fathers, and brothers in jail or and serving very long or even life sentences. And while those groups did not agree on how I should approach solving that problem, they agreed that that was a huge problem confronting our community, and they agreed that many of our current policies were just not working. Those policies, which included things like the three strikes you're out, mandatory minimum sentences, and treating more juveniles like adults in the criminal justice system, had passed those types of policies, had passed with flying colors through the state and federal level. So that kind of policy was very much embraced with support not just from one side of the aisle, but both Democrats and Republicans, and a lot of strong public support for those measures. But by putting more people in prison, those policies were supposed to solve our crime problem. But surprise, surprise, they didn't. And that's one reason why when I got elected to the Congress, I asked to serve on the House Judiciary Committee.
This is Representative Sanchez. She needs to study up a little more. Crime went down when we filled the prisons.
To help our children, and most of all, to help our families. And that is the goal that brings me here today. We need to explore our options with respect to youth crime, and we need to question some of the assumptions that we have about it. Maybe our crime problems can't be solved by being solved on crime and just throwing money at the problem either. But we're seeing that our crime problems aren't going to be solved by ever harsher punishments and ever longer sentences. So I'm proud now at this time to introduce our speaker for this afternoon, Mark Kleiman. He's a professor at UCLA School of Public Policy and an expert in crime and drug policy. From 1979 to 1983, he worked for the Office of Policy and Management Analysis in the Criminal Division of the U.S. Department of Justice. And in 1982 through 1983, he was its director and a member of the National Organized Crime Planning Council. Since receiving his doctorate from Harvard's Kennedy School in 1985, he has been studying crime and drug reduction policy. His most recent book, When Brute Force Fails, How to Have Less Crime and Less Punishment, is the culmination of years of research on crime and deterrence. He's a founder of a number of programs across the country that have demonstrated success, not by increasing the severity of punishment, but by increasing the swiftness and the certainty of it. I think that his hearings have the potential to really change the game, to stop the perennial right-left battles about whether we should build more prisons or fix the root causes, about whether we should employ zero-tolerance policies or legalize drugs, about whether we should have universal concealed carry or gun prohibition laws. Those are the perennial ideological battles that we see. And instead of engaging in this ideological debate, Professor Kleiman suggests that we learn from the experience of programs like Hawaii and Project Hope. Project Hope shows that a truly convincing threat of punishment doesn't actually have to be carried out very often. So myself, I'm very intrigued by his thesis and grateful that he is here in person to discuss with us his novel theories. And so if you will please join me in welcoming him and I believe my colleague, Mr. Scott, from the Judiciary Committee is here and maybe we'll like to say a few words on the matter. He is somebody that that works very diligently on youth crime issues on the Judiciary Committee. But would like to welcome you and to welcome them to today's discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Linda. Thank you very much for your leadership on the Judiciary Committee. You've been a valued member and in subcommittee chairmanship and in all the work that we do on the Judiciary Committee. You've been a very active member, and I thank you. This is one of the issues that is extremely important, and as you have pointed out, we really have a choice in crime policy. We can do what evidence and research shows reduces crime, or we can codify slogans and sound bites. We have been codifying slogans and sound bites for decades. We now lock up more people than anywhere on earth by far in the United States. The Pew Research Forum did a study a couple of weeks ago that showed that 500 per 100,000, any incarceration rate over that was actually counterproductive. We now lock up 700 per 100,000 in the United States. In some minority communities, it's up to 4,000 or even higher per 100,000.
This is Representative Scott, and we have the lowest crime rates we've had in 50 years.
And prevention, early intervention, and more effective law enforcement. Mr. Kleinman has shown in his studies how you can more effectively utilize the law enforcement resources that we have, but we also have to, law enforcement can respond effectively to crime, but it doesn't reduce crime. The crime reduction has to take place before crimes are committed. We have introduced the Youth Promise Act, which will require the community to come together and propose evidence-based, research-based proposals, holistic proposals to get young people on the right track and keep them on the right track. So many people are in fact the prison today that the Children's Defense Fund calls it the cradle to prison pipeline. We need to construct a cradle to college, a cradle to the workforce pipeline. Because once they get into college or the workforce, by and large, they're not much of a problem from the criminal perspective. But we know, and we can also, in terms of prevention, keep kids on the right track, keep them on the right track. But even within law enforcement, we can be more effective, and that's why we're delighted to have Mr. Kleinman here today. And thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Scott, for that very kind introduction. Congressman Sanchez, it's really an honor to be here in the presence of two such leaders on crime control. Congressman Sanchez is one of the sponsors of the Path to Success program, which gets community colleges into youth detention facilities to give you some hope that those folks will turn their lives around. If I started listening about Bobby Scott's accomplishments in crime control, we'd be here all afternoon. But I've got to mention the Youth Promise Act and his current work on strengthening indigent defense, which is a great scandal. And finally, before I start, I need to give my special thanks to Celeste Drake. If I were to say that Celeste Drake was the best master's in public policy student ever to graduate from UCLA, probably somebody would say, well, so-and-so was just as good. But so I can say with confidence that we've never had a better master's student, and we're utterly, utterly thrilled by your career. So thanks to all of you for taking time on a Friday afternoon. I come here today because I'm worried and excited. I'm worried because we have too much crime and too much punishment. Both of those are now major social problems. I'm excited because doing what we already know how to do and spending less money than we're spending today, we could have half as much crime and half as many people in prison 10 years from now as we have today. So I think you'll agree that that's something to be excited about if it's true. And for the next few minutes, let me tell you why I think it's true. So I want to talk about how bad the problems are. I want to talk about how we got into our current social trap. And I want to talk about how to get out. And then we get to the interesting part, which is your questions and comments. We have half as much crime today as we had 15 years ago. A big crime collapse was between 1994 and 2000. Having reduced our crime by about half, we only have 250% as much crime as we had when I was growing up. And I'm not that old. we have five times the homicide rate that we had that any other advanced democracy has. Congressman Scott pointed to the incarceration rates, which are scandalous and more scandalous if you look in particularly impacted communities. The same thing is true of the crime rate. Homicide is the leading cause of death for young men in some neighborhoods in this city and every major city around the country. Those are almost invariably African-American and Latino communities. So both crime and incarceration are horribly concentrated by race and class. Everybody pays the cost of crime in ways they're not aware of, because we're now used to doing things to avoid victimization that we didn't used to doing. People talk about the need to fix our land use policies to more heavily concentrate population in order to reduce our carbon footprint. And people live more closely together, they drive less. Nobody in that discussion that I've heard has mentioned the reason they moved to the birth in the first place, which is to get away from crime. And unless we can fix the crime problem, we can't get people back into the cities. The fear of crime shapes everybody's life. When I was 13, I lived in Baltimore. I was a baseball fan, and I was cheap. And the most cost-effective way to see baseball back then was what was called a twilight night doubleheader. Back then, you only paid one admission to go to a doubleheader. So at 6 o'clock, I would take a bus, changing at Park Circle, which was a rough part of a rough town even back then, go to the stadium, watch the games, come back at midnight, taking the same two buses, changing in the same rough neighborhood. And my parents, who were not by any means negligent parents, never thought twice about it. This was considered perfectly normal behavior. I don't think many snow-class kids have the freedom today that I have been, unless they're living in some sector, in which case they have a different kind of lack of freedom. Crime avoidance has a different set of costs. On flipping, if you think about the economic geography of any city in the United States, it's shaped by the fear of crime. Huge neighborhoods with well-developed utilities and roads and labor force and no factories. Like the spatial mismatch between job opportunities and where unemployed people are is something everybody knows about. But a few of the people who write about that write about why those factories and why those stores moved in the first place. It was true when I lived here. I think it's still true that the District of Columbia has no movie theater south of Capitol Street. Those are jobs, and not only services aren't available to people who live in those neighborhoods, those are jobs that's not available to people who live in those neighborhoods. So if you grow up in a crime-ridden neighborhood, your opportunity to earn a legitimate wage is diminished. The security of whatever you earn is diminished. Your personal security is diminished. It's not surprising that people turn to crime. So one of the lessons here is that crime is criminogenic. Those 2.4 million offenders we have in prison and several million more who are on probation or parole or bail or used to be in one of those statuses, those people are a subset of victims. It's not as if the world was divided into criminals and victims. I mean, maybe Bernie Madoff was never victimized before he committed his crime, but he's pretty unusual in that regard. Most of the people who turned into long-term serious offenders were abused as children, were beaten up on the schoolyard, have experienced victimization in a myriad of ways. As with crime, with prison, we have an enormous disproportion by race. I wish it were true that that were a product of racism, product of decisions within the criminal justice system to punish black and Latino offenders more heavily. But it's not true. I mean, because if it were true, you could fix that. You could try to fix the criminal justice system. But if you actually look at the numbers both about perpetration of crime and about victimization, since almost all crime is committed within rather than across race and class lines, you'll discover that the disproportion in prison is roughly disproportion in the offending rate. Right? So if you look at the African-American proportion in prison and the African-American proportion of homicide victims, it's the same number. So some of my friends have been portraying the racial disproportion in prison problem as a melodrama with a victim and a villain. And I want to say, no, it's a tragedy. Not at all clear to me that you'd make the average African-American community better off by releasing back into it all of the offenders who are now in prison. They're mostly not there for nothing. As my friend James D. Wilson said, prison today is pretty much a lifetime achievement award. So we're in a social trap. We have massively too much crime, massively too many people behind bars. Curtis Scott said we can't solve this problem with sound bites, but let me offer a couple of sound bites that may help clarify. Bill Stuntz at Harvard Law School did a calculation. Took the African-American prison population and the African-American total population and divided to get prisoners per capita. That number is higher than the number you got if you did that for the Soviet population in 1952 in the land of the free. I submit to you that this is not okay. The current level of incarceration is not sustainable, is not tolerable. So, how do we get out of that trap if we also think that crime is a real problem, and a real problem for precisely the communities that are also victimized by incarceration? The answer has to be to get more bang for our punishment buck, to make every cell day do the maximum amount of deterrent and incarceration work, that is to say, not having three strikes laws. We have to learn how to punish people and control their behavior, while not paying their own wardrobe without locking them up. And we also have to take advantage of the many opportunities to do crime control without enforcement. It's not true that randomly increasing social services spending would have a big impact on crime. It is true that virtually every social service agency could make a large crime control contribution if it were focused in that direction. And I'll try to give some examples. Lincoln said that if we knew where we were and how we got here and where we were going, we might figure out what to do about it. So let me give you a canned history of how I think we got where we are. Starting about 1962, we had a crime boom. There are a million theories about why we had a crime boom. But since none of the people who made up those theories predicted the crime boom in the first place, I think you can take them with a grain of salt. If you want to take a look at my book, I've got my own canned theory. It covers all the facts. But so do lots of other theories. Anyway, we had a crime boom, even in the face of an economic boom. And then coming in about 15 years, 20 years behind that, we had a prison boom. I was one of the people back in late 1970s, early 1980s, who looked at the fact that we were decreasing prison capacity in the face of a crime explosion, therefore making crime a lot safer to commit from the point of view of the offender. And I was one of the people pounding the table saying, hey, we got to start building some prisons. There was a good case for that at the time, I think. But like most of the people who were saying that back then, I now feel a little bit like the Sorcerer's Apprentice. Does this thing have an off switch? Because we continued to build prisons while crime increased through 1994. And then as crime dropped through the floor, we continue to build more prisons. So we now have 2.4 million people. I keep having to change this talk because the number goes up. And it's possible that the current state fiscal crisis is going to finally put a crimp in that, but I'm not sure it's going to put a permanent crimp in it. Unfortunately, it's not true that prisons are very expensive. The total prison budget for the U.S. is about $50 billion, which is about a quarter of total law enforcement spending. About a tenth of, say, elementary and secondary education spending. So it's not the case that there's tons of money in the prison system that we could be spending on social programs instead. So though I'm glad that fiscal crisis is slowing down prison building, it's not the best reason to start building prison. And partly probably as a result of the prison building boom, crime did indeed go down. But it's a little bit of a surprise why crime didn't go down more. If we had a quintupling of the prison population and a halving of the crime rate, then the punishment for crime must have gone up by a factor of 10. For burglary, I've actually done the numbers, about a factor of 6. So one way to think about it is, wait a second, we've sextupled the punishment for burglary, and burglary went only down 50%. What happened? The demand for burglary must not be very sensitive to its price. For drugs, which is the field I know better, we have multiplied by 15 the number of cocaine dealers in prison, while the price of cocaine has gone down by 90%. So for some reason, we're running into a failure of deterrence. Not a complete failure, but the deterrence is not doing the job that it should. Engineers have a saying that when brute force fails, you are not using enough, which has been the slogan of our criminal justice system, as far as I can tell, for the last 40 years. So why does brute force fail? What's the puzzle there? I think the answer is because severity is no substitute for swiftness and certainty when it comes to changing behavior. Moreover, severity is the enemy of swiftness and certainty. A severe penalty can't be applied with certainty because you run out of cells. Every person doing 25 to life in California for stealing a plate of pizza is keeping 50 people away from 6-month sentences for stealing a car. And, of course, the more severe a penalty is, the more fiercely it will be resisted, the more due process you need. So we have to learn how to deliver the minimum effective dose of punishment. Now, any more than the minimum effective dose is too much. It's said that an optimist sees a glass as half full, and a pessimist sees a glass as half empty. But an engineer sees that you're using twice as much glass as you need for that amount of water. And that's our criminal justice system today. So basically, you have to teach the criminal justice system where everybody who's ever successfully raised a child or trained a puppy already knows. You need clear rules, clearly communicated, and consistently enforced. And if you do that, you can make threats, make warnings, do most of the work. As my teacher Tom Schilling likes to say, the perfect threat is the one that never has to be carried out. And that's the way to get around the paradox of having both too much time and too much punishment. Learn to let threats do more of the work. When I worked in Boston City Hall, where there was a little bit of a corruption problem, there was a saying, nobody steals a hot stove. If you make the consequence immediate enough and certain enough, you can change behavior. So having made those broad claims, let me give you some examples. One way to think about the work I've been doing for the last few years is I've been trying to prove that it's possible to do in theory what a bunch of people in the field have already done in practice. So, High Point, North Carolina. This is David Kennedy's project, and he's got several applications. He's a John Jay. Now we work together at the Kennedy School. We were thinking about cracking down on drug markets. And it turns out, we've been known for a long time, at least since Operation Pressure Point in New York, that if you put enough cops in a flagrant drug market area for enough time and make enough arrests, you can break that market. And when it's broken, it stays broken. Right? Because the market's a focal point. The market only exists because people expect to be able to come there to buy and sell. If you can break that expectation, you can put the market out of business, and it will stay out of business, but it's ferociously expensive. Operation Pressure Point, 1,000 cops, 6 months, 17,000 felony arrests. And the number of felony convictions in New York City courtrooms did not go up that year. So basically every conviction that came out of Pressure Point was somebody not being convicted of a burglary. So Dave and I were sitting around and trying to figure out how you could shorten the time it took the drug dealers to figure out that, no, you really couldn't deal here anymore. And David said, what if you put up posters? What if you just put up posters all over the neighborhood saying, this market is closed as of November 1st. Don't be here dealing after November 1st because you will be arrested. Well, who's going to show up to deal that day? And if the answer is only a few people, then you can actually arrest all of them. And so you might be able to do a crackdown without paralyzing the criminal justice system. Well, only 20 years later, he got the police in High Point, North Carolina, to to try that. They were frustrated. They had a crack market in their African-American community, West End. High Point, for those of you who don't know it, is a town of about 100,000 in the Piedmont of North Carolina. It's an old mill town, somewhat economically depressed. Had a crack market back from the beginning of crack. And cops have been making arrests back from the beginning of crack. And there was always a replacement dealer, which is the nature of drug markets, the reason it's mostly useless to put drug dealers in prison. I mean, if they're bad people on other grounds, then there's, right? But putting a drug dealer in prison doesn't eliminate drug dealing the way putting a burglar in prison eliminates a burglary. The guy you put in prison is not going to be committing any burglaries, and nobody's going to replace him as a burglar. Not to compete for opportunities, but drug dealers have to compete for customers. So they did some community organizing, and this story is told in David's book, Deterrence and Crime Prevention, which I commend to all of you. But I'm going to skip the community organizing part and get to the meat. They identified all the dealers in the market, and there were only about 16 of them still active, mostly living at home with their mothers because crack dealing now pays below minimum wage. Identified all the dealers, identified the three of them who were genuine bad guys who shot people. They couldn't prove that, but they could make buys again, buy from them, so they did. They buy from all the dealers. So when they had a case against every drug dealer in the market, they arrested the three super bad guys and sent them off to prison. And sent a team consisting of a cop and a community member to the homes of all the other dealers, inviting them to a meeting at police headquarters the next night, promising that they wouldn't be arrested, encouraging mom to come along if she was willing to do that. They came. They watched the video of each of them making two drug sales. Police chief said, raise your hand when you see yourself committing a felony. They handed out notebooks, one notebook to each dealer, with the felony case against him in it, including the arrest warrant waiting for the judge's signature. And then the chief said, now that I have your undivided attention, I have an announcement to make. The market is closed. Nobody's dealing in the West End from now on. And you guys aren't dealing anyway. If we smell that you're dealing, you're going away. We don't have to buy from you. We already bought. Well, the next morning, the market was closed. Nobody was there. I mean, some frustrated buyers were there, but nobody was selling. A day later, somebody said, oh, this is great. I'm a monopolist in crack in the West End. Well, he got popped the first day. He put out like a sore thumb. And then there weren't any dealers. And 2 weeks later, there weren't any buyers. And the market's still closed. 5 years later, they made five arrests. The market's still closed. Now, that did not eliminate the crack problem in High Point. You can still buy crack. There are strip clubs on the edge of town. And not a single lap dancer has complained. The point of the program was not to abolish crack dealing. It was not to, you know, get crack users not to be able to get their drugs. It was to return the West End to the people who live there. And that worked. People were pushing baby strollers around what had been a war zone. This has now been replicated, East Hampstead, some other places. All right. Quick cut to a new scene. Honolulu. Steve Alm was U.S. attorney, now a state court judge. Probation officers are bringing him probationers for revocation. 7, 8, 9, 10, 12 violations, mostly missing appointments or dirty for methamphetamine. Methamphetamine's a big drug. In Honolulu, these were active people. They had an average of 14 prior arrests. And the judge said to the probation officers, okay, I see why I should revoke this guy. He's clearly not getting the message. But why am I getting this file now when it's too late? This is his ninth violation. What happened the first eight times? The probation officer said, Your Honor, we've got case loads of 180. They come in once a month. 10% don't show up. 20% are dirty. We can't write up all those reports. And if we did, you couldn't hold all those hearings. So we jawbone the ones we can, and the ones we can't, we bring to you. So I said, okay, I hear you, I understand that, but you wouldn't train a puppy that way. wouldn't raise your kid that way. I want to know about the first violation. And the probation officer said, Your Honor, is there some part of him possible? He would like us to explain more slowly. We can't do that. So Judge Arm is a very reasonable guy. Said, okay, let's compromise. Make a list of the people who found out so often that the next time he'd bring them in for revocation. That was 35 people. And he called all those people in for a new judicial proceeding he invented on the spot called a warning hearing, at which he read them the Riot Act. We all want you to secure probation. You're not doing your bit. From now on, you call this phone number every day. If your color comes up, it's your day to come in for a drug test. You have till 2 p.m. Don't show up. We'll chase you. Show up dirty. You're going to jail that night. I promise. You're all grown up. Take responsibility for your lives. I'm not interested in excuses. Show up for the test. Be clean. Now, I hope not to see you again. Well, he didn't hope very much, right? 30% violation rate. He's expecting to have 10 hearings the first week. He had 3. The next week, he had 2. Fewer than half of those 35 people ever had to come in for an actual sanction because nobody feels a hot stove. And that was true for people with very high addiction severity index scores, people with very long criminal history. We've now done a randomized controlled trial. And the results are clear. Something like 80% of a group of criminally active methamphetamine users can and will stop. Will be stably absent in the community for periods of months, and we haven't run out that far, just by telling them there's going to be a consequence if they keep using. And now you boil it down to a small minority that really needs treatment, and you can give them really good treatment. Hope costs about $1,400 per probation, over and above routine probation costs. Saves about $6,500 per year in reduced incarceration. Big decreases in recidivism, big decreases in revocation. Now, if it turns out you can actually enforce probation conditions, oh, and the...
Well, interesting. My first comment, and we can't have a long discussion, we can't have any actually, would be I think the professor needs to meet some more criminals. I really do. Some would go at their crime, and the data would support this, no matter what the punishment is. And the one that we know that works, that if you're sitting in a prison cell in Lucasville, Ohio, you can't be doing shooting robberies in Toledo or some other part of the state, or the same thing would be true in any state. That we know for sure. We know that for sure. Nobody leaves the cell tonight and goes out and commits robberies and comes back. These other things are a little bit flimsy. So anyway, it's an interesting book. You can hear the rest of it on Book TV. It's Professor Mark Kleiman, and he's adding to our literature, and we need that. Well, we'll sign off, and we'll see you next week. We might do the thing on the gun. The Higher Gun Law next week, and we'll have Vera Lynn sing her beautiful song, We'll Meet Again.
We'll meet again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again, some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know, tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We meet again, don't know where. don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.